What I'm going to try to talk about tonight, hopefully relatively briefly, is the question, vexing and contested question, of whether the human person is naturally religious. And I'm going to begin, the first half of the talk I'm going to look at two opposed views, opposed to one another, both of which I'll disagree with. And in the second half of the talk, I'm going to look at a view from Thomas Aquinas, which, unsurprisingly, I'm going to recommend. So you have a rough outline. You don't have to refer to the outline, but it gives you some notes to look back on and also some references to some of the important books mentioned. So let's start the story with St. Bonaventure, who is the great scholastic doctor of the Franciscan order in the 13th century in medieval Paris, who is commenting on Peter Lombard's Sentences, which was a great text of theology that everyone commented on to get a doctorate in the 13th century at the University of Paris. And he asks a question, which is a standard question that everyone needs to respond to. Is the virtue of religion, basically, is the virtue of religion a supernatural virtue? Now, what that means is the act of being religious fundamentally motivated by grace? Can you be rightly religious without grace? Is grace the presupposition of the act of being religious? Now, Bonaventure, in his own sort of discreet way, argues that it is a supernatural virtue, and it is principally by charity that human beings are able to be religious. At least this is the way I'm reading Bonaventure. The argument there being that it is the infused grace of Christ and the charity of Christ poured into our heart by the Holy Spirit that allows us to be religious in a rightly ordered way. Now that is obviously a very theological answer. So, is the human being naturally religious? No, not so much. The human being is supernaturally religious. This is, by the way, not such an outdated opinion. If you look over the world around you and you think about all the people you know who are not religious, you might say, well, it's not so natural for human beings to be religious. It's actually the effect of grace. And when you listen to people convert who are purely secular people, who become religious people, they often will attribute the becoming religious part to the discovery of grace. Now, Bonaventure is basing himself in part off, it's his way of reading St. Augustine. If you go back in time to the 5th century and you read Augustine's City of God, Augustine argues there that Christianity is the true religion. And he contrasts it with the Greco-Roman pagan religions that he characterizes as false religious traditions. False because erroneous and misleading. And in Book 10 of the City of God, he develops the thesis that Christianity is able to be the true religion because the charity of Christ allows us to offer true sacrifice to God. So, to develop the idea a little bit more, going back from Bonaventure to Augustine, when the grace of the Holy Spirit is poured into our hearts and the charity of Christ is given to us, we begin to offer our life to God, offer our lives to God in constructive ways through divine love. And we are able to offer rightly ordered sacrifice to God. And Augustine sees this happening epitomally in the Eucharist. This is Book 10, Chapter 6 of the City of God, that in the Eucharistic sacrifice, the whole church offers herself to God in Christ, and by the grace of Christ is enlivened to live true religion, true sacrifice. And he contrasts this with the pagan religions, which he says are built around social conventions, primarily marked by disordered love of self. So actually, there's a lot of suspicion of human religion in Augustine that outside of the order of grace in Christianity and the church, a lot of what you find in the world of human religion will be social constructs of political control, false promotion of persons, disordered love, and there'll be all kinds of this-worldly advantages to religion that are potentially pathological. So if you look at the seeds of distrust of religious behavior in the West, a lot of it actually goes back to theologians. And if you go back behind that, it goes back to the Old Testament, to prophets. Because the denunciation of problematic ways of being religious, you find it originally in the prophets in the Old Testament. And you find it going forward in St. Paul, and you find it going forward in Augustine, and you find it going forward in Bonaventure. So they're not in grave discontinuity with the Old Testament idea. So let me contrast that with a typical modern tradition. And now I'm going to pass through here the history of some very great minds with a picture postcard version of their arguments. So I'm oversimplifying. But what I want to do is try to narrate a kind of a development of thought, you might call it an evolutionary tradition of how you get from one viewpoint to another viewpoint to another viewpoint in degrees of intensification, so as to come to the 20th century conviction, which is prevalent among many, and I'm going to take Freud as archetypal, but I might mention Nietzsche and Marx, the modern conviction that religion is effectively an unnatural social pathology. How do we get there? Well, let's go back to Immanuel Kant. Immanuel Kant, as I've given you the dates here, is alive from 1729 to 1804. His mature period is around the time of the American Revolution, French Revolution, and that is very apropos because the kind of move towards revolutionary enlightenment democracies that are purposefully secularizing, that have some version of the distinction between church and state, separation even of church and state, and in France, of course, deeply anti-clerical dynamism. This is all in the background. And Kant is largely approving of this, of course. He sees himself very much as the sort of philosophical founding father of modern secular liberalism, I would argue. In any case, he not only took on that mantle, but he did effectively, he has received it. I mean, he tends to be treated that way now. So he wrote a little book called The Prolegomena to Any Future Metaphysics in 1783. And there he raises the question, can the human mind know by its natural powers that God exists? Or, if to put it more simply, is it reasonable to believe that God exists? And he begins to stake out the position that he's going to explore more thoroughly in the big book, Critique of Pure Reason, in 1790, which is not atheistic, which is not theistic, but what you might call a kind of principled agnosticism. The philosopher can know that we can't know if God exists. So Kant takes on the one hand, the kind of confident philosophical monotheists, and on the other hand, the confident philosophical atheists, and he argues that none of their arguments are actually can reach a determinate conclusion, and that the mind is in a certain way naturally agnostic in its settings. That's one way to put it. But, and here's the key thought, he does think the idea of God is very important for the human being to help organize its own reflections on the meaning of life. That's to say, a theoretical explanation of reality and a structured human morality. So the idea of God is, you might say, useful. It's not something we can't from the idea of God conclude to his existence, but it's a useful idea for structuring our understanding of reality. He calls it in the Prolegomena to Any Future Metaphysics an illusion of transcendental reason. It's very interesting. He says the idea of God is an illusory idea, an idea that is a helpful illusion of transcendental reason. And what he means by that is when you try to think about the whole of the universe and its meaning, where it comes from, what's going on in human existence, it's helpful to think about an idea like God as a useful kind of hypothetical concept for imagining an overarching meaning to life. And so similarly with morality, he says, you don't see the realization of full justice in history. A lot of people who are just are treated miserably, and a lot of people who are unjust thrive. And so it's helpful for thinking about morality to think about God as an ultimate resolutional principle after we die, that there would be some kind of justice given by God if God exists. So God is a kind of useful idea for thinking about the organization of the universe and the organization of our moral lives. And then in the end of his... so then he goes on in the religion, in his important book, Religion Within the Boundaries of Mere Reason, to argue that it is irrational to depend upon grace for the way that one lives, because responsibility requires that we do things by our own natural powers and not in dependence upon the Christian idea of grace. And that for morality, the real principles of religion that matter are what you would call the second table of the law in Exodus. If you know anything about the kind of history of interpretation of the Ten Commandments, they're the two tables of the law. The first three commandments are about our relationship with God. That's the first table. The next seven commandments are about our relationship with other human beings. That's the second table. So what Kant is saying is morality is primarily about your relationship with other human beings, not your relationship with God. So you don't have to tend to a right relationship with God religiously as part of your moral character. What you have to tend to as part of authentic morality is your relationship with other human beings. Totally typical principle of modern secular liberalism, articulated forcefully by Kant over and against traditional Christian religious ideas. Okay, and then you say, well, where is all this going? Is it all motivated toward, you know, life after death or something like that? Not so much. In a late treatise he wrote, Perpetual Peace, a Philosophical Sketch from 1795, he articulates the what he calls kind of the ideal horizon of the future of human history. Where should we all go as a political society? We should go toward universal democracy, representative government, liberal secular regimes that allow full participation of the citizens, of individual rights accorded to all. It's a kind of treatise of modern liberalism. That is the new heaven, so to speak. The new heavens and the new earth are not transcendent in heaven, but in the horizon of history in the future. So you can see the emergence of the kind of religious zeal of modern secular politics, that we put our hope effectively in the destiny of human beings to construct a future perfect democratic society. So religion is useful insofar as the idea of God is important insofar as it helps motivate this future political program. Okay. Now you say, well, that's kind of still pretty benign in the sense of it's certainly not traditional Christianity, but it's not treating religion as a toxin or an unnatural vice. Well, no and yes. I mean, he does think that sacramental religion is a superstition, and he thinks Catholicism is toxic. He's very clear about that in Religion Within the Boundaries of Mere Reason. He thinks that dependence on grace is a problematic, and he thinks strong belief in the divinity of Christ is problematic. So, I mean, traditional Christianity is already a problem. You might call it supernaturally originated religion. And what's left in natural religion is largely kind of morality, of political morality, going in a particular direction. Switch ahead on the, we're taking metro stations, and we're going to skip ahead a few metro stations. We're passing Hegel, and we're passing Schelling, and we're going down the metro stop to Feuerbach. Feuerbach's born the year Kant dies, and he's got a famous book called The Essence of Christianity. Now, Feuerbach's just a straightforward atheist, and his argument is that man has projected the idea of God as an idealization of his own moral nature. So it's not God who created human beings. The human being has created God. And he talks about what he calls the anthropological essence of religion. If you look at what religion is, essentially, it's a human attempt to create idealized notions of morality. So is religion bad? Well, no. Religion is pre-modern. Religion is naive. And when we kind of mature as a civilization and as individuals philosophically, what we ought to do is condense out of our religion or purify our religion of its mythological elements and take out the purely moral truths and moral sentiments that are hidden within the myths. You might say it straightforwardly like this: God is a mythological idea or an illusion of transcendental reason, a construct of human reason that human beings have used to narrate to themselves idealized moral portraits of human behavior. And what we need to do is kind of lift back the veil of mythology and get the moral principles that are there and construct a post-religious atheistic humanism that's based on some of the moral truths that are encoded in pre-modern religious traditions. So Catholic, this, and in a strange way, you can treat Catholicism more gently here. It's a pre-modern mythological tradition
which has a lot of deep moral values in it, and we can grasp those moral ideas and purify the religion of its theism. It's very condescending, I know. But then, you know, then you keep the moral truths.
So you see why it's on a sort of spectrum. Religion was useful and acceptable under certain usages for Kant. It's become a past relic that can now be purified, but still is not thought of as in itself a toxin. It's like, you know, it's like symbolic ideas for people who are not yet purely completely rationally mature for Feuerbach. And then we can move forward to Sigmund Freud. Freud is 1856 to 1939, and Freud, like Nietzsche and Marx, are very important for the atheist project. By this time, you have a lot of theoretical atheism openly circulating, deeply effective in modern culture. You have, for example, the famous, highly influential atheistic arguments of David Hume. You have other people, certain ways of reading Spinoza, read him as an atheist, has been deeply influential throughout the Enlightenment. Certain of the French revolutionaries, the English deists, quasi-atheistic. And then you have the emergence of kind of 20th century atheism in the wake of Marx and Nietzsche. Here's the thing. If God really doesn't exist, if atheism is the right interpretation of classical monotheism, and monotheism is an illusion, then we need to figure out why there are so many people who still are monotheists. And it can't just be because people all base their lives on reason and argument, and people just haven't learned enough arguments, because people wouldn't be motivated just uniquely by the question of how much philosophy they'd had. There's something else going on. So you need an anthropological explanation of the generation of religion. I mean, even in our own day, plenty of Christians, lots of Muslims. What's going on? What's important and in a certain way genuine about Marx, Nietzsche, and Freud and all in their distinctiveness is they want to get an explanation for what is going on in human beings that they become religious. You see? And that's when you really start to get the idea of religion as a social pathology or personal pathology. You need to figure out why there are theists. And it's hard to be an atheist intellectually for a couple of reasons. There's a burden to it in that you have to first give good arguments why you think that the metaphysical explanation of monotheism doesn't work and is a bad argument. So you have to kind of at least argue presumptively against belief in God. But then you need to also give arguments for why people become theists. And that's not so easy, actually. So anyway, but these guys try to take that on, and they are brilliant men. Okay, so Freud has a beautiful little book, beautiful in an intellectual kind of way, called Civilization and Its Discontents from 1929. It's very accessible, highly recommended. And it's part of it is about how people generate religious views. And one of the main claims, which I'm just going to say in a very summary fashion, is that God, for Freud, is an idea generated by human beings in the face of death and finitude to give themselves the impression psychologically that they are cared for by a personal agent. That the world is explicable in terms of what he would call a transcendent paternal love. That the fatherhood of God is watching over them. Now Freud, of course, fatherhood, motherhood. What he's saying is the child learns to see the world very much as encompassed by the care given to him or her by the stewards who are his mother and father. And then what the human race has done is kind of projectively thought about the whole of reality as stemming from a paternal cause or a maternal cause, a personal caring cause, so that in the face of death, when we see like the brutality of our mortality, when we see one another die, when we see the sort of harshness of disease or the physical universe, which may seem impersonal, when human existence doesn't seem geared towards the care of persons, but on the contrary, when human existence looks like, our life in our world looks like it's kind of deeply impersonalistic, we cover this over with a veil of paternalistic monotheism. Tell ourselves God cares for us. I find that a very alluring hypothesis of atheism. Now, he has some problems. He thinks it's also, he's got other theories. It's also a form of social control. Freud thinks social controls are important. That's not all bad for him. He doesn't think people should just follow their own id and do whatever they want because they have deep forms of aggressivity and orientations towards what he would call sexual deviancy that need to be checked by social controls, and that helps make them mature persons. But he thinks religion can, in a kind of Feuerbachian way, can kind of be a placeholder for that until we reach a more mature atheistic psychological state. So psychology in the modern atheistic humanist world can do some of the work that religion was doing by giving you a more self-conscious form of social control. There are different theories of the generation of religious... for Freud, we are alienated from the seeming impersonal forces in the universe. Death, the physical universe, seeming impersonal to us. And then also maybe alienation in human society, where we feel others don't care for us. And God is a psychological remedy. For Nietzsche, that's another interesting theory, as maybe some of you know from Genealogy of Morals and, say, the Antichrist and other books like that. He thinks that Israel created monotheism as a country that was under oppression through its priestly class, as a rulership class that were in exile, in the Babylonian exile, and under suppression by a greater power, as a morality of the weak to overcome the power of the strong. And that monotheism is effectively a moral system that privileges weak people to claim in the face of strong people that in the end, through God, the principle of morality, there will be a redressing of social inequalities. And Nietzsche thinks that social inequalities are in some way inevitable and even in a way good, because the noble and strong ought to thrive and not be enslaved to what he would call the kind of false morality of moral weakness, of mercy morality, so to speak, of priests and Christians. Jewish priests and Catholic priests. And Marx, it's got to do more with social alienation with regards to the despair of the poor in the face of social inequalities. So you experience a life wherein a minority of people control the means of production. You can't really have economic upward mobility. You live in really crass conditions of poverty and desperation, and you have no hope of ameliorating your life in this world. You can't create real equality. So you transfer through religion your hope for some kind of moral remedy to life to God and to heaven. And Marx just wants to say, look, let's give up on creating a heaven in another world for the unjust. Let's create their heaven in this world by stop feeding them the opiate of religion and liberating them so that they can take over the means of production so they can actually have a fair, a genuine life of equality with others, and we can create conditions of social equality in this world and not in the world to come. So he sees, the alienation created by massive social injustices, especially in impoverished regions with lacking education and means of access to social conditions of advancement, as being a generation that sort of cesspool in where religion is generated. Okay, there's a lot to be said for all these views. They're very interesting. There's elements which a person who's a religionist could agree with. One of the sort of simple things to say in response to all that is, you have to, there's sort of a fundamental distinction. It's a very simple distinction, but the fundamental distinction you sort of have to make with regards to human freedom and the human person in general, which is the distinction between what conditions us, even what conditions us vividly, and what determines us. And when you let things that strongly condition us, like wealth or poverty, or our social situation, or our psychological situation, our psychological state highly conditions us, when you let that stuff determine what's going on in free will and in the intellectual search for the truth, then you get ultimately, inevitably reductive views of the human being. So that if you carry the Freudian program, the Nietzschean program, or the Marxist program forward, as people have all done, in very strong fashions, you get deeply reductive views of human personal motivation and actually end up in anti-humanist, impersonalist kind of views of human beings as strongly conditioned by social factors, psychological factors, and you don't really get to the depths of human dignity and what motivates us, which motivates us and determines us from the inside is the search for the truth and the search to love in freedom. So if you can't articulate that, you can't articulate what a human being really is. And all three of those gentlemen have a little trouble on that front. Okay, I'm turning now to Thomas Aquinas. So what I've done is I've looked at ideas of religion as a supernatural reality and ideas of religion as a social pathology. There are some interesting ways to connect both of these views. You could argue it this way: without grace, a lot of what Nietzsche, Freud, and Marx and company say about human religion is true. Human beings do project, as Feuerbach thinks, a lot of ideas onto the divine. Or to quote the strong words of John Calvin, the mind of man is a factory of idols. It's a wonderful Calvinist statement. The mind of man is a factory of idols. Any good Catholic can agree with that. And there's a way in which that's a very Feuerbachian thing to say. So you have sometimes deep alliances that can be formed between modern skeptics like Feuerbach and traditional Augustinians. Without grace, the human being doesn't have a very clear venue or pathway to God and tends to invent lots of bad ideas. Well, but that being said, Thomas Aquinas has a more nuanced and I think more attractive position. So let me sketch that out. So let's go back to Bonaventure. Aquinas has Bonaventure in his mind, probably, when he comments on the question from the sentences that Bonaventure also comments on: is religion a supernatural virtue? Or is religion basically something that comes about because of the charity of Christ? And Aquinas says, no, no. Religion is natural. And he says it's a part of the cardinal virtue we call justice, justitia. So to be religious is natural, and it's a part of being a just person. Okay, that's a very strange idea in the contemporary world. If you walk into the offices of NPR and you said, "Are you doing a story tonight on how you need to be religious in order to be a just person in the contemporary American context?" And I think they would find you intriguing at best and probably more like dangerous. So, and yet Aquinas does argue that it's part of justice. What does he mean? So justice is the pithy definition of justice for Aquinas is, justice is to offer to each one what is due to him. And that's very complicated in its outworking, because what you owe your spouse is different than what you owe your boss. It's different than what you owe somebody in a store when you have an exchange of goods. It's different than what you owe the mentally handicapped child who needs special aid, a special needs child. There's a different justice there called distributive. But what you owe in justice to the group that you participate in as friends, what you owe a friend, justice is complicated, very plastic, not arbitrary, but subtle idea in Aquinas. And it's a principle of order. So to do what is just is to render each one what is his due within a given order. And it's very relational. It's very interpersonal. So when I'm just toward you, you're just towards me, we're creating the conditions for interpersonal friendship within a given context. That context is different if it's a marriage. It's different if it's a work environment. It's different if it's a church, etc. Okay. Relations of order between persons that are just. But Aquinas also thinks there's a kind of relationship of order of the human being to God. All human beings are naturally ordered toward God, whether they want to be or not. It's inscribed in their very intellect and in their will as free, rational creatures. I'm going to talk about this in a minute. Just to be the kind of thing that the human animal is, as a rational animal, is to be a radically religious creature. You might say at this point, we are radically religious animals. We are radically religious animals because we are by nature oriented toward our source. We might get it wrong. We might be, Mr. Feuerbach might get it wrong, or somebody who's in a tribal religious tradition that's strongly polytheistic might not have a perfect idea of God. Feuerbach certainly has a very bad idea about God, metaphysically benighted, even sophisticated and metaphysically benighted. But these people beyond, or more foundationally, underneath their intellectual thoughts and their constructions, are deep down in their very being, in their very person, naturally oriented toward God, and they are therefore motivated to be religious according to principles of right order or justice. They should try to live in harmony with God. Okay. Now, I give you a passage from the Summa Theologiae. I'm not going to read that, but it's just to give you, like, just to prove I'm not making things up. Occasionally, I put in a passage from Thomas Aquinas, and it also allows you to go and find it later and read a little Aquinas. Now, I want to talk a little bit about the inward structure of the act of religion. Aquinas then analyzes, well, how does the virtue of religion unfold in a human being? And he has the inward acts and the outward acts. This is very straightforward. Anybody who's in the Catholic or Christian tradition is going to recognize some of this right away. It's outward acts that stem from inward acts. So the inward essence of religion, the essence of religion is inward activity, and that's divided between intellect and will. So it's very interesting that Aquinas treats the question of what does it mean intellectually to be religious? And Aquinas places prayer, the habit of prayer, in the intellect. It's a very interesting question to play at a kind of really pious party. I'm invited to pious parties, so parties where they're like religious people, you know, say, well, what do you think? You think prayer is in the heart or in the intellect? Of course, most people will get all confused. Most people say both. Some people say it's in the heart. But it's interesting that Aquinas is formally speaking prayer is in the intellect. Okay, so to pray is to think on what is most ultimate in reality and to orient one's life towards God. By offering your life to God intellectually, like thinking about how to orient your life toward God and asking God to watch over your life. Right? So he calls it, basically, straightforwardly, I think, the lifting of the mind up to God. Now, that builds for Aquinas on a platform or foundation of philosophical realism. He thinks it's just realistic to think God exists. And here's the first place we sort to... We've disagreed with Bonaventure, now we're going to disagree with Immanuel Kant. Aquinas thinks, unlike Kant, it's absolutely reasonable to think God exists. And it's unreasonable to think he doesn't. Actually, Aquinas thinks atheism is not a very intellectually viable path of explanation for the world. Now, you have to get into Aquinas' metaphysics, Aquinas' arguments of the existence of God, which, as you know, is a very dense subject. And that's when, you know, you can go on the Toastic Institute on SoundCloud and listen to some really good lectures by other people on that topic of why Aquinas thinks God exists. But kind of as a natural extension of this, is you start to think there are good metaphysical reasons to think the world is created and depends on God, and the next step is to talk to God. I was talking to a philosopher not long ago, a young aspiring philosopher, a graduate student, in a country that is not predominantly Christian, where very few people are baptized. And she was saying to me, I like what Aquinas says about God, but she says, but do you pray to God? And I was not dressed like this because the country, you couldn't get into the country very easily if you're dressed like this. And I said, well, you know, given that I'm a Catholic priest, we typically do try to pray to God. And she said, but that's frightening. I mean, you could come under kind of, you know, you could easily fall into superstitious practices. That's not a bad concern, right? That's not dumb. I said, right, but God also is a very great teacher. So if you don't just study God intellectually, but actually talk to God, he can actually help you, you know, orient your mind toward the truth. It's those ways which entering into a personal relationship with him help you. But you can see my argument to her is there's a kind of organic relationship. Like, I've learned a lot from reading the books of this physics professor, and now I'm going to go study with this physics professor, but I'm going to make sure I never talk to this physics professor. Because then I would learn more. I should talk to the physics professor, right? So analogously, the mind can orient itself naturally toward God, contra Immanuel Kant, and then I can begin to talk to God, and that is like the foundation of prayer. Now, the inward act of religion that is in the will is devotion. Now, devotion is not what we typically think of as like Catholic devotions. Our devotio moderna, if you study modern theology. Which is like a pietistic movement in Germany in the 15th, 16th centuries. Devotio is letting your will come under the attraction of what is sovereignly good. It's you know, to take a somewhat crass analogy, but not, I mean, one that's human enough, it's a little bit like coming under the attraction to another person when you fall in love with someone. You sort of like come under the sway of a good. Now that's much more passionate, romantic, volatile, potentially unstable. Not always leading to the best discernments, etc. But, you know, it's something psychologically vehement. Religion is less psychologically human,
but it's deeper because it's orienting yourself towards the good that lasts eternally. Like God is the good that kind of endures forever. You know, you have passages of Julian of Norwich, all manner of things will be well, or Teresa of Avila, to just trust in God because this life is passing by quickly and will soon be with He who is eternally good. It's kind of grounding of our being in the orientation toward the transcendent sovereign good of God. And that's much more invisible. It's not very psychological because the will is the spiritual faculty for Aquinas. So it doesn't really depend on how I feel, what I eat for breakfast, social conditions, whether I'm poor or rich, whether I'm the king or the pauper, whether I've gone through analysis or not, whether I have, you know, whether I'm the subject to the will to power or not. There's this like deep motivation to want to be happy in the will, or fundamentally motivated by a desire for happiness, according to Aquinas. How are we going to be happy? By possessing what's really enduringly good. What's really enduringly good is the transcendent sovereign goodness of God. So there's a natural inclination, insofar as we want to be happy perennially, to want to know God and to devote ourselves to God and to come under the radiant attraction of God. And then devotion is to serve others and to treat all other things in light of the love of God. And so to treat other human beings as God's creatures, made in His image, to serve others for God's sake as a way of growing closer to God, and to consecrate the world to God. Aquinas thinks it's natural to consecrate the world to God. That's to say, to live in all things in view of God as the ultimate principle or purpose of life. He just thinks that's natural. Okay. So then outward acts are like adoration is when you pray in your body. So when people kneel to pray and devote themselves to God in their hearts, they're like physically practicing what he calls adoration. And then when they offer things externally to God, that's sacrifice. And he thinks that this anthropological dynamism of adoration and sacrifice you find throughout human history and human religiosity. Human beings are naturally religious. They try to find ways to relate to the divine. They do this through outward postures and through gestures of religious ritual and sacrifice. They make up religions. The reason they make up religions is not because they're especially projective, a la Feuerbach, but because they fundamentally are oriented towards the transcendent divine reality of God, and they need to find a way to relate to God as human animals who exteriorize their interior dispositions of prayer and adoration. I find it very commonsensical. Prayer and devotion. So, I mean, Aquinas will then ask, and another passage I've given you shows this, that he asks, is sacrifice natural? Does it pertain to the natural law to offer sacrifice to God? And his answer, congruent with everything I've been saying, is yes. So Aquinas thinks sacrifice, the essence of sacrifice, is to show the primacy of the love of God in human civilization by offering our lives and all things to God through structured collective rituals in which we help each other pray to God and devote our lives to God. Okay. So, for him, a culture that no longer has a sacrifice or a way to relate itself to God visibly in a public way is a very inhuman, in some way, vitiated society. And so secular society for Aquinas looks pretty unnatural. Now we're going back the other direction, doesn't it? You know, so now I'm pushing with Aquinas against all those modern masters of suspicion and saying, well, you're the ones who are suspect because you're pushing a deeply natural behavior, which is human religiosity, out of the public square. And that is inhuman because we have a natural relationship to God we need to cultivate.
Now, here's my last thing. I want to talk about the supernatural grace and the concrete exercise of religion and a little bit about the vices.
So if you can have a virtue, you can have a vice. The good news is you have the possibility of virtue. The bad news is you have the possibility of vice. How do we go wrong in religion? Well, Aquinas says we go wrong two ways. By worshiping the wrong thing, or you might say by being ultimately devoted to the wrong thing, or by worshiping in the wrong way. Now, to worship the wrong, or both. Worshiping the wrong thing can be very religious or not so religious. If you worship the wrong thing in a very religious way, you worship something that's not God, or you attribute properties of God to something that's not God. I mean, that could be like totemism. You know, there's like traditional things in tribal religion where people worship literally, do think a stone is a sacred extension of God, or in some way embodies the divinity, or has divine power. That could be polytheism. It could also be pantheism if you confuse God with the world. There's ways to go wrong about what God is. It could become idolatrous or problematic. Okay, so there's bad ways to worship. And
then there's like non-religious forms, which is more prevalent. And this is when you're devoted to things that might be ultimate, that are actually not the creator but created. You know, like the ultimate principles that from which everything derives are the smallest particles of physical matter that happen to have haphazardly arranged themselves contingently in a given order that's given rise to living things, which then accidentally evolved highly functional frontal cerebral powers and then gave us these supposedly higher powers of reason and morality, so that we are basically all just accidents spit out by the universe through small collections of matter aggregated in particular ways that are entirely accidental and haphazard. Okay, fine. The ultimate metaphysical explanation of reality then for people like Dawkins or Stephen Hawking is physical matter. They know a lot about physical matter. They're great biologists and physicists, they're not great philosophers. It's not wise to attribute the generation of the whole of reality to the smallest bits of physical matter haphazardly arranged. That's a bad philosophical explanation for reality. And it's a kind of superstition for Aquinas, because you're putting your explanations of reality in places that you ought not to. It's kind of like a bad religion. You could also be devoted to politics as the final end of man and go down the Kantian path of the treaties on peace and say that the highest aims of the human being are humanist utopia, democratic secularism, and life and society. And that's your greatest aim. What are you doing with your life? Well, I'm helping advance this political cause that's the highest echelon, the furthest horizon of human existence. No, we're made for more than that. Right, so that's a kind of superstition with regards to the end. Right, so that's kind of false religion of a secularizing sort.
Then you can be religious, badly religious, in the way that you offer religion yourself to God. And this would be like, you could believe in God, but then you could also do things that were
deeply disordered for God, like human sacrifice. I mean, human sacrifice is actually extremely prevalent in the history of the human race. Often that's allied with problematic conceptions of God. But like ancient China, Hawaiian religion in the 15th, 16th century, certainly South America, the prevalency of it, Mesopotamia in the archaic era before Israel, even overlapping some with the time of Israel. So, you know, human sacrifice is a very clear case of superstition that's not uncommon. Suicide bombing is a form of superstition because you use a practice that's intrinsically immoral to advance monotheism. That's not licit. You can't do things like that. It would be analogous like torturing people in order to advance, to get them to be religious. That's also a form of superstition. Okay, so there's lots of bad ways of being religious. I mean, it could also be telling lies, manipulating people to convert. You know, there's all kinds of profaneness that exists in the religious world that's a kind of superstitio, a bad way to serve God. Okay, to finish then, here's the thing where I'm doing a kind of an inclusio here and coming back to Augustine. Aquinas sees himself in his own way as an Augustinian. We are naturally religious, but the problem is we live in a fallen world where our nature is wounded. So I said our mind is made for knowledge of God and prayer, and our hearts are made for happiness and for love of God. The problem is in a fallen world, we're also marred by ignorance of God. The wound of the intellect that is ignorance constitutes an original sin. We don't know God really very well. And we're wounded in the will by malice and kind of the wounds of self-love. So Aquinas says in the concrete exercise in history, in the concrete living out of our religious inclinations, we are naturally religious, but we will tend to get it wrong without grace. We will tend to have a difficulty having right, good ideas about God, and we will have, he says very overtly, well, but we really can't succeed in loving God well and rightly, loving God effectively above all things, without the help of grace, because of the wounds of the human heart. So then Aquinas, having forcefully articulated that it's natural to be religious, then gives us very sobering warnings.
As this plays out historically in a fallen world, you have a lot of ignorant ideas about God, projections, weird ideas. He has generative ideas about false religion that are sort of like Blair Brock. He says often people in the past have created images of God that are based on the desire to propagate the support of the state, like the Roman emperor being a kind of avatar of the divinity, and you need to sacrifice the Roman gods on behalf of the emperor. It's all a kind of political superstructure. It's arbitrary and unreal. So he says things are very radical because he thinks we go very wrong and in the intellect, in our understanding of God, and in the will, where we have these really kind of very often polluted motivations for being religious. So how do we get it right? Aquinas says, the healing of the religious instinct in man comes about by way of grace. This is a very Augustinian point. Revelation teaches us who God is. God has revealed himself to us in the prophets, in Israel, in Christ, in the apostolic revelation of the New Testament, and in the life of the church. God has instituted sacraments. The seven sacraments are visible manifestations of the grace of Christ that keep us, as it were, on the path toward God, so that we know God and we can live a kind of focused, healthy, religious...
We can live in religious justice and with a kind of religious focus in the world of grace, in the world of the supernatural life of God. And charity, so revelation helps us heal the mind through the grace of faith, faith in revelation. And the grace of charity helps heal the human heart so that we can really love God above all things, especially when we connect this with the sacraments of penance or confession and of the Eucharist and the sacrifice of the Mass. We can learn to devote our hearts and our lives and our societies to God through the liturgical worship and the sacramental power of Christ in human civilization. So in the end, Aquinas does think you really need the church and the liturgy of the church to get this right. But outside of the liturgy of the church and the mystery of Christ, you can find elements of healthy human religious inclination. You can find healthy ideas about God, you can find healthy sentiments of devotion to God, and you can find sort of natural religiosity expressing itself. And that's normal, because human beings are naturally religious. But it needs to be healed and elevated, healed by grace and elevated by the grace of Christ, so as to be sort of saved. So in the end, Aquinas is pretty Augustinian, and the answer to the question, is man naturally religious, is yes, but it's complicated, because in the fallen order, often when we live out our natural religious impulses, we absolutize the wrong things, we don't understand the sacred very well, and we have trouble devoting ourselves to the highest good in a genuine fashion. And so we can be naturally religious in a successful way, but we need grace to do so. Grace doesn't destroy nature. Grace heals nature, purifies it, and elevates it. Thank you very much. So I'll take questions for a few minutes. And I see a hand here on the front. I think you would you like me to use the microphone? I can also repeat the question if you prefer. Why don't you go ahead and I'll repeat the question.
Sure. Tyler O'Neill with PJ Media. I'm just wondering, I read a book by Rodney Stark recently who argued that religion has kind of an economic aspect, not in the Marxist sense of allowing the oppressed to have some outlet, but in the sense of humans naturally believe there's a God or that there are gods, and that we ask the God of gods for specific things, and they can give them to us. And he talks about the difference between a pagan society where there are multiple gods in control of different spheres of human life, and a monotheistic society where you have one God who's in fundamental control. Does Aquinas have any sort of suggestion for approaching a religious economy in that way, or is that a newfangled social idea?
Well, I mean, okay, so that's a complicated question, which I'm going to ask. It's like,
I'm going to rephrase your question this way. What's the social, the economic and social utility of the religious impulse, and could it be construed positively? And the first thing I would say is, the question is posed in a utilitarian fashion. That's to say, is religion useful for the economy or for the development of our economic creativity? Now, I'm not opposed to asking a question like that, but I don't think we should ask it naively. Because let me state a thesis that would be one way to answer that. Yes, I think belief in God is good for the creative capitalist energies of free Western societies, and therefore we should all be religious just insofar as religion is good for capitalism. Right? I'm just saying that would be a line of argument. And by the way, there'd be like a certain number of agnostic or atheist libertarian capitalists who would think that, and we'd be perfectly happy to say, in somewhat cynical ways, well, religion is a useful illusion to keep people from to support the free market and to fight for communism. We need the Catholic Church to keep people from becoming communists so we can keep the free market going, things like that. Right, so when you go down, you use utilitarian arguments, you go, there's a spectrum to them, and so you can look at social utility, but you have to also be always thinking about what's the priority, because if God is the ultimate reality that explains our origin and our final end, then ultimately, the money, money, that's not really going to be very helpful to us in the long run. And God is going to be very helpful to us because he endures forever. And, social prosperity, not so much so. But, okay, that being said, there's a more nuanced way to answer your question, which is, I think, the sense in which you asked it, which is to say, if we take for given that a certain amount of free market conditions of human existence, however much the state intervenes, a certain amount of creative free enterprise is healthy for a modern market economy system. Market economy systems can do better. We need that for the flourishing of human civilizations. And religion is true. And is there a connection? Does like the religious devotion to God in some way help recalibrate human free creative behavior? Well, I don't think Aquinas asked that question, but there's definitely a way of thinking that Aquinas might say, the more you are oriented towards what makes you most ultimately free, the better you will act at a lower regime of freedom. So the deeper your freedom, the more your freedom is rightly oriented toward God, which gives you your deepest source of freedom and your deepest sense of autonomy and well-being, healthy autonomy, the more you're going to be able to treat other human beings as subjects of justice, think about the political good in a measured way, and think about free initiatives with other people in an economic market system, and also maybe be more free and creative as an artist. But then, see, creativity and capitalism is really more about art than it is morality. And artistic creativity, like that, which is a very important part of life, not reducible to morality. It's very complicated to talk about artists' relationships to God. And capitalists are kinds of artists. They may be more technicians. But, athletes, artists, capitalists, that's a kind of energy of artistic creativity. And it's often hard for artists to bring themselves, they love their art so much, it's hard for them to bring them service to God. Right? So entrepreneurs don't always have it, it's not so easy for them to always bring that under control, like to orient that toward God or offer that to God. And so similarly with artists, they often don't like to bring God into their art. It's not obvious to them how God should be included in their art. You have a lot of secularism in modern art. So you get into interesting questions there when you talk about whether religion is useful. So I just say analogously, is religion useful to modern art, to the artists? It's not so easy to say. It can ennoble his art tremendously. So I think it can ennoble the creativity of a kind of capitalist entrepreneur, but it doesn't have to. I think it does create space against tyranny. I do agree with that. I think that having a deep sense of God present in a culture does actually mitigate against the forces of human tyranny. So in that sense, it creates space for human freedom and creativity.
Yeah, so Aquinas' definition of justice is giving another his due, and religion for Catholics I guess the Orthodox, there's a way of sacrificing the physical signs in which you do give God his due.
Sacrificing the what?
With using visible signs,
yes,
in which you do,
right,
give God his due.
Right.
But naturally, how can anything you do be giving God his due? Particularly with the fallen nature, but even prescinding from that, even in the state of pure nature or something like that, how can anything that a created being does be in any sense due or proper to God?
Yeah.
Good question. Well, the short answer is, what is due on the part of the subject to be rendered to the other is proportionate to the powers of the subject. So the child in the family is not proportionately responsible for gaining a salary to feed the family. The parents are. So you wouldn't come home and say to a three-year-old, "What have you been doing all day? I've been earning a living. Come on, kid." And, you know, the kid's looking at you, smiling, moving the blocks around on the kitchen floor, right? No, I mean, the child is not really a major contributor. They participate in a different way on a level of love, and mostly in recipient. So these are what Aquinas would call friendships of inequality. And he says that we're in the most radical friendship of inequality with God, because God has given us everything and sustains us in being and all that we are. So paradoxically, on one hand, we can't give God anything in proportion to his infinite dignity. And on the other hand, we owe God everything. So we can only give God everything, but it's not that much compared to God. And so the way we do that also, for Aquinas, runs through our nature. So it's not like, I need to give God everything, so I'm going to go out and annihilate finitude to signal the need for the infinite. I mean, you can imagine how this would work. Honey, could you go out today on Saturday and mow the lawn, finally? I mean, it really does need it. I'm busy doing other things. Sure, honey, I'll do that in a minute. Right now, though, I'm honoring God, who's infinite. And the thing is, like, praying to God by reading this book is a much more proportionate way to tend in terms of my rational nature to give my mind to God. And mowing the lawn is, like, so banal that it's really not a way to give my life to God. Many things make up arguments like this. But actually, you can mow the lawn for God because everything's finite, right? So you can do finite things for God in accord with your nature. Now, whether mowing your lawn is really very natural or not is another interesting philosophical question. But certainly, a lot of things we do, like you know, changing diapers or taking care of kids, for example, is an eminently natural thing to do. You can offer that to God as a proportionate natural action consecrated to God, right? So this is the way that the argument here is metaphysically, the orientation of your life towards a sovereign good doesn't supplant or suppress the orientation of your life towards secondary goods, even very noble ones like, you know, family life or the pursuit of philosophical truth or whatnot. So being religious doesn't mean you have to suppress everything else. You can orient all that stuff proportionally towards God. But unfortunately, that's all we can do, really. You know, we can't give God something that's... Now, we do believe in the Mass, because there's the infinite dignity of Christ present there, that Christ is offered to God a sacrifice of strict proportionality through a kind of fittingness that God himself envisaged. God became human so that the sacrifice of Christ could be of infinite dignity. There's an infinite dignity to the human sacrifice of Christ because of who Christ is. And that's the deepest principle of human religiosity. You were looking for me to give that answer. That's Anselm of Canterbury in the Curdeus Homo, Why Did God Become Human? And Aquinas reiterates that argument. So in the Mass, you are offering God something of infinite dignity, and you're able, because it's a sacrament, to be, the sacrament proportions is for our sake, to allow us in our finite proportionality to be united to Christ in his act of offering.
Yes, ma'am.
Do you think that there is a relationship between the, like, as a nation develops, that your religiosity would develop simultaneously?
Okay, so your religiosity would stem from a develop, like, as you have the civilizational development, right? So there's the old argument that as people get more fluent and more educated, this is a kind of Marxist argument, that people are going to become, religious commitments are going to wane. And I'm very vexed by that. I mean, in sort of my instinct to say that is in the short term that often does happen.
But the other side is that we're seeing civilizations that are not religious also disappear. Because there's another side to this, which is part of development is,
widespread secular societies is a relatively new phenomenon in human civilization. So we're still watching it unfold. But the crisis seems to be about natality. So even though Kant seems to be all about hope in the future, as opposed to hope in heaven, they don't seem to be very good in hoping in the future enough to have children. So non-religious people seem to have difficulty making sacrifices in terms of having children and giving their lives for their country and things like that. So it seems like you've got a kind of the place where you might say the vice of non-religiosity or of secular superstition tends to erode a highly developed society is in the anti-natality mentality. I mean, part of where you see it is in abortion. I mean, taking control over all the circumstances of human generation and birth, but also just the goodwill to have children, have families. I think this is related in part to belief in the future, trust in the future, providence, belief that there is kind of a hope for where we're going. So there's like new features of secular society that seem to mitigate against their own futures. And then you see, of course, you know, especially in Islam, in Europe, the rise of natality in the religious civilization can ultimately provide a principle that can usurp or displant a secular society. So I think that that's a drama that's unfolding in front of us. But I mean, I guess as a philosopher or someone who dabbles in philosophy, I don't see the problem with having a highly developed, you know, educational system and on the contrary, I mean, part of it, the other thing is, when you get to a certain aristocratic echelon of success in life, you know, okay, we have money, okay, we have honor, okay, we have power, okay, we have health, what's next? You do then acquire metaphysical restlessness. And I do think that metaphysically, the realistic answer to that is religious behavior. So there's another way in which I think a certain kind of maxing out of material and educational success leads to new questions of explanation that are open to religion. Aristotle says, even in the metaphysics, it's only when ancient societies reached the echelon where they had a leisure class. He says it started with the priests in Egypt. I don't know why he started there, maybe it did. But anyway, he says in ancient Egypt, when the priests had leisure time, then you had a genuine leisure class. That's when mathematics developed. Because people had the freedom to speculate freely and think about things like math. Okay. So, I mean, you know, mutatis mutandis, in a culture where you have enough time on your hands, you actually can begin to have deep questions of meaning unfold, and they can then, I think, reassert themselves, actually. Why don't I take one more? I'll take this lady's question over here, and then I'll stay and answer questions and talk to people. Do you want to just follow your question? I'll repeat it.
Sure. Relatedly to what you were just talking about in terms of the development of religion among the legion class, I've seen among the members of the secular upper middle class who have turned to some degree to religion, embracing pantheism and physics as kind of a substitute to traditional established religions. I was wondering if you could comment on that.
Yeah, so then you have also something I didn't talk about at all, which is, just to allude to briefly, a kind of Western concern that maybe the great monotheistic traditions got it wrong, and in light of our new scientific learning of the last few hundred years and our awareness of what the human being is through the explanations given us through modern physics, chemistry, and biology, the more salient metaphysical explanation of reality would be found in something like Buddhism, a kind of materialism that seeks meaning in, let's call it an elevated religious consciousness of our own passing contingency, an acceptance of our nothingness in a positive sense so that we can live out the ethics of compassion, or maybe a more Vedantic Hindu form of reflection that thinks there's an inward divine spark where we're on some deep level at one with the fundamental principle of the universe. The inward human being in the deepest element of our soul is divine or is identical with the deeper element of the divine in all things, and the body is passing through, and so we kind of embrace what we're, you know. I do think sometimes this is a kind of,
anesthetization of oneself in the face of kind of the plight of suffering in the world, and it's a way to maybe even, I would say somewhat cynically in a kind of Marxist way, remove oneself, I'm not a Marxist, but remove oneself from commitments to others. You know, I mean, I'm worried as a Christian about the kind of way that theories that depersonalize the human agent can also be ways that we use in not so subtle ways undermine our personal responsibility to others. So when very affluent people start going to yoga clinics and spas and that, I get very nervous about what is that doing to the principle of responsibility. But that being said, the deeper metaphysical sense of this that you find in some people reflectively expressed philosophically is that the modern scientific era and Buddhist metaphysics meet up much better. And there's some important philosophers arguing this elsewhere. But my short response to that, and it really is going to be short, is twofold. It doesn't do justice to what a human person is. For Christianity, personhood is central to ontology. That's to say, being. The most central feature of being in the world, the most important element of being, in of all created being, is personalistic. God made the world for persons. And persons are at the origin of the world, in the sense that the Trinity has created the world for personal communion. So I think that's a very deep metaphysical discernment. Do I think the world is created for personhood, or do I think that the world is ultimately impersonal? Is personal identity ultimately a kind of illusion or a passing thing that's going to evaporate? Or is personal identity something structural in reality, like God made the world for personal identity, and so the soul is personal, even after death? And I'm willing to defend the Christian view philosophically as well as theologically. I do think there are very, very strong philosophical arguments for thinking that the human intellect and the human will are intrinsically immaterial in their inner elements, and that the human person in his or her deepest personal identity and core exists even after the demise of the body, and that there's an ultimate principle of reality from which we originate, who's God the Creator, who we need to describe in logical ways as personal in some way. You know, so, I mean, I would want to respond to Buddhism on metaphysical grounds. Thank you very much for your attention.